It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. We humans can live a long time, long enough to do a lot and see a lot. It's worthwhile to listen to our elders. On today's show, I have a climber who topped some of the world's greatest peaks 50 years ago and then never stopped. Tom Choate has seen Denali change environmentally and culturally as he's climbed it every decade over the last five. I'll also be joined by one of Alaska's toughest runners, Tim Middleton, who completed more than 60 marathons and helped start some of Alaska's biggest races. It's an interview about keeping going in your 70s. In both cases, the charm and insight from these men is inspiring and really encouraging to hear. We'll also have some other diverse and interesting stuff on the outdoors on today's show. From Portland, Maine, we'll hear a 10-year-old girl learning to be a balloonist. And from here in Alaska, a story about beekeeping. It's all ahead on Outdoor Explorer, Alaska Public Media's audio outdoor magazine. Well, I'm very excited about my guest who's in the studio right now. Tom Choate is a fun and charming gentleman. He's 83 years old. We don't always give people's ages at the top of the show, but part of his age is his remarkable accomplishments. And you may have heard that in 2013, he climbed Denali at the age of 78, having climbed it in each of the previous decades. He climbed it from the 1960s on, right, Tom?
Yeah, sir.
So tell me about climbing this mountain in 2013. It sounds like you had a few doubts about your ability to do it when you started thinking about it or it was suggested to you.
Yeah, of course. One tends to fall apart after turning 70 at the minimum, and I had a really bad foot for quite a long period of time that never really got fixed. And during the early part of my 70s, I was able to go for 6 hours and then 5 hours and then 4 hours and then 3 hours. And it got to be extremely annoying that I couldn't go out for any long day walks anymore.
Oh, wow.
But I'm talking about going without drugs. There's no doubt that you could take a bunch of ibuprofen or whatever and go. But I found out that that's a quick way to hurt yourself. So I almost refused to do that pain medicine kind of thing and just got ornery and said, I'm going to tromp on it until it hurts so bad I got to quit.
Wow.
And that was what was affecting me at the point when my 50th anniversary came up.
50th anniversary of climbing the mountain.
Climbing the mountain back in the 60s. And I had been with Denali and Denali Park and fell in love with it quite a lot earlier than that. In fact, 1954, I fell in love with it.
Yeah.
But never got to climb it.
And 63 is the first time you made the summit.
63 was the first big summit. That
is incidentally the year I was born.
Yes. Well, anyway, going to the back to the 100th, what I should say what happened that year was that it coincided with the 100th anniversary of the first official ascent in 1913. And so the Park Service put on a big celebration, and they brought a lot of high-class climbers and famous people and so forth. And my friends all said, well, you got to at least have a go at your 50th anniversary trip. And so it still would never have happened if I hadn't had some dedicated friends who said, well, we can make this possible.
And because you were very skeptical.
Oh, I was very skeptical because how the heck can you climb Denali on 3 or 4 hours
on a bad foot.
A day?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It just doesn't work. And in fact, nobody climbs the summit in less than about up to the top and back in less than about 12 hours. So I thought there's no way. On the other hand, the lower glaciers used to have a lot more camps than they have now. And so I knew from experience that you could set up camps in various places along the way. So I went ahead and organized this expedition with a lot of extra food. And we would take approximately 30 days worth of meals with us. And that's old school because there are people that go up there and I consider cheaters who will go up with half as much food as they need and then beg off of the climbers that are coming down having summited and have extra food and extra fuel. I don't believe in that because a part of that was training from the early days when you couldn't go out.
But back in those days, there's nobody else out there.
Exactly. Yeah. And you had to have everything. And so I kind of overplan in that regard. And I planned 30 days of food. Well, the weather and a few other peculiar things actually kept us out a little longer than 30 days. So we took a lot of extra time, roughly double what a good fast climber might be able to do.
How did you manage it on that last summit day with your foot?
Well, let's not go to the summit day. Let's just say that before we did that, we did these little four-hour journeys, and I would go out, and they would be patient and go along at my slow pace. And then when my 4 hours were up, we'd see, well, we're about halfway to the next camp. Let's go ahead and start putting a camp in. And I would do that, and these generous friends of mine, Stephen and Bruce, would actually say, okay, you make the camp, and we'll go back and grab another bit of the load. And so they were doing 8 hours of work while basically I was doing 4 hours of hard work on my legs and then just the rest of it building snow blocks and other silly things you do making camp.
How did you feel on this trip, having done it each decade all the way back to 1963, 50 years? I mean, I think that would be interesting in a lot of different ways, and different people with different personalities would have different responses to that. What were the main sort of emotions that you have felt on this trip?
Oh, I fell in love with the mountains so much that I just love the chance of going back to these familiar places. There will be a number of changes. And each time I go back, the glacier seems like it has less snow and there's more crevasses and further up on the mountain. In fact, there's little less snow and a little more steep ice. So in many regards, I consider it more technical to climb than when we went in the early days, when you could basically snowshoe from bottom to top.
Is that right?
But that would depend on the perfect snow, and it usually blows and gets hard and nasty up on top, and the old ice axe and crampons have to come out. Yes, there's no doubt that climate change has been very dramatic on the mountain. And when I finally did get back up there in 2013, the route changed very drastically because there's so much less snow there. And you go over onto the ridge really early on and then go along a ridge to get to the top. 50 years before, you could walk along essentially straight up the steep part.
Interesting. And there's no living person who has that perspective other than you, because you've been there the longest and you've been there, you have this memory of experiencing it, which is one of the great things about age, is that you actually get some perspective on things.
Well, it gives me a chance to see the climate change anyway.
Yeah.
And the other thing which counteracts the fact that there's less snow on the mountain, and therefore it's a little bit more technical, a little bit more crampons and ice axes and changing of routes, is that there are more people and more guided groups and more safety-conscious folks. The Park Service is more concerned about trouble and whatnot. And so places that used to be just find your own way have a nicely built trail with markers, in some cases fixed ropes and pickets to attach to it. Pickets are big, long stakes, essentially hold you in if you should happen to slide down a slope and you're properly hooked in with your rope.
Mm-hmm. So you made it to the top.
Well, let's go back a little step. What the peculiar thing that happened was that some people will say, well, you just got fitter, and it did take me 3 weeks to get to the bottom of the hard part. So I was substantially fitter. I did not properly prepare for this. I'm not really a good athlete that spends months of training properly. I did train a bit. But there's some peculiarities of climbing Denali that, well, at least in some ways, and that is, for example, that you typically pull a sled. Well, if you're living down here at sea level in Anchorage, you're not very likely to be pulling sleds for practice, or you should, but you don't. So the first thing I found out was that my legs might have been fit, but my shoulders weren't, and my hips in particular pulling the sled weren't. So I had to do quite a lot of getting back into the groove of things.
Oh, I imagine.
And up on the top of the mountain, I actually succeeded better. By switching away from the sled and going ahead and eventually putting as much as 50 pounds on my back.
Wow. You kind of got conditioned through the course of the climb.
I did. I got conditioned. And I don't think personally that I conditioned my bad foot. It just doesn't make a whole lot of physiological sense to me. But for some reason, above 15,000 feet, when it gets really steep and where I know there's no good place to stop if you only get 4 hours, that day I got 6 hours. Hmm. And the day after that, I got 8 hours. And I got up to 17,000 feet, and I went out for almost 10 hours. And it's like, well, maybe I will get this mountain after all. But it still doesn't make sense, but it happened.
I know. Well, the other thing that doesn't necessarily make sense is they tell us that the cardio pulmonary systems degrade over time, and that each decade we get a little bit weaker. And here you are at very high elevation doing some very strenuous work carrying a 50-pound pack, but you still seem to have been able to handle it.
Well, yes and no. I go extra slow, and I've never been a good athlete because I have what are known as brown fat and slow twitch muscles and all of this kind of thing. And if I take much more than a single step a minute, which is half the pace of runners, who'll probably do 120 in the gym, the only way I can go all day long is to go one, two,
single step a second.
And then up on top of the mountain, you actually train yourself to go with extra breaths. So you'll go one, two, three, four, five, two, three, four, five. And it's like forever, but you're getting all these little breaths in between, and you just get into that kind of a rhythm. And the key to it is not stopping.
Don't
finding
stop,
whatever it is, however many breaths it takes, so that you can get rid of that lactic acid, you're ready. And the Denali rest step is pretty famous. Quite a few people do it.
I think it's I'm just thinking about the key to it is also that you tried it. If you hadn't tried it at all, it wouldn't have made it either.
Oh, well, I had learned earlier decades, like, you know, in 2003, I traversed the top of the mountain, and I was already almost 69, and the same thing applied. I had to start doing some pretty fancy breathing or whatever, or I wouldn't have been able to do it.
Yeah. So are you ready to tell me about the summit?
Well, going to the summit was one of these very peculiar things where I thought, maybe I'm ready. And I actually felt pretty good. And the trail was relatively readily marked. We didn't leave especially early, so we actually had the advantage of somebody putting in the trail ahead of time. And so I got up to the pass and didn't feel any problems at all, and stopped for a little while and then started working our way up. And there was a bit of wind, but the weather really wasn't good. It wasn't bad. It was reasonable. And all these people ahead of us, and I thought, well, this is really good. And then up around about 19,000 feet, I started to see people who had sort of broken off from their party, and they weren't looking very good, and they looked like they might be getting a little altitude sickness. And for the first time in 3 weeks, I actually passed another human being. It's like, wow, for 3 weeks they've been passing me all day, every day, and finally I passed another human. Maybe I'll make it.
Tortoise in the hare, huh?
Exactly, tortoise in the hare. And then, wouldn't you know it, something very, very strange happened that I know of no time on the mountain it's ever happened before or since in 50 or 60 years of information. And that is that just as the first people were getting on the summit, and I was catching up with a group of people that were down in the big flat area just below the summit known as the ballpark, the weather came over, closed in, and down came the clouds, and they were black and really, really dark, and all of a sudden there's this rumble and flash, and lightning had actually struck up on the top of the mountain.
Wow.
And this, it's quite normal in the summer to have thunder clouds, say, down at 12,000. And to look down on thunder clouds, I've seen that before on the mountain, but no way had anybody that I know of ever heard of thunder and lightning on the top of the mountain. Well, everybody was pretty shocked by all of this, and suddenly there were people coming off of the top of the mountain just pouring down without ropes and panicking and everything else. And one guy came by me, and I said, "Stop, you're okay down here. What happened?" And he showed me the back of the head where a bolt of static had gone from his ice axe in his pack to the back of his head and burned a hole in his hair.
Wow.
And it's like, man, no wonder you're getting out of here. I'm going to stay here and wait. Uh-huh. And that's part of my nature, is not to go quick, but maybe to spend a lot of time working at it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, okay, I've got enough food and water and what have you. I'll stay here an hour. And there was another group. Everybody else turned around, but there's another group that these guided groups, I think, are under a substantial amount of pressure because they get like 2 days. They've spent mm-hmm. all this money, and they get about 2 days they can get to the summit.
Right.
So these guys were on their last day, and they were in they said, okay, let's wait. And, mm-hmm. and that's really good because I've only got one person with me now, and we can sit and wait. Well, about an hour and a half of blizzarding and carrying on later, I thought it was going to get better, and then lightning struck again. So it's like, okay, this isn't going to work, and I had to give it up. Took us probably a total of 16 or 17 hours that trip to get back down to camp.
Wow.
So I had to blow the next day. It was already almost time to leave by the time we got back down. Of course, in the early part of June on Denali, there's no real darkness. There's mm-hmm. one stage where you can't properly see where you're going, and I usually take that time out to have a cup of tea or something
right.
and wait for it to get lighter.
Yeah.
That is, in fact, an interesting thing that people may not know, and that is that in the warmer stages of the day, the lower parts of the mountain can get incredibly hot. It can be 70 degrees on the glacier, and you can get terribly sunburned because it's reflecting back mm-hmm. off the snow at you.
Light from every direction.
So those of us that have got a lot of experience recommend turning the day upside down and getting up at 5 o'clock at night and making your breakfast and starting out about 6:30 or 7 when it's starting to cool down, and then going through the middle of the night when you can cramp on better and stay on top of the snow better. So I'm quite used to being out in the middle of the night, and there we were coming down off of this mountain. It took another 4 or 5 hours to get back down.
Wow, you must have been exhausted.
Well, I was, but I was also elated at this incredible ice and snowstorm and all what. But anyway, it took me a couple of days to get back.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I was fully recovered the second day because the weather was, if anything, a little worse.
Mm-hmm.
Took me a little longer. I got a little bit exhausted trying to keep ahead of the people on what they call the Autobahn, and mm-hmm. everybody gets piled up behind other people. And mm-hmm. I made the mistake of being ahead of somebody else who goes faster than me.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting in this little gully at the top above the pass. The trail doesn't go through the pass exactly anymore. And the clouds are down, and I'm feeling tired, and I've got my thermos out, and I'm about to take. And I forgot to tell you that because it's the 100th anniversary, there are all these famous people on the mountain, and I'd been talking to them. Well, around the corner comes John Krakauer. He said, "There you are, old man. Oh, look how far you're going. You're doing really well." And it's like, oh, my God, I can't turn back now. So we plugged on and put it on and ended up on the summit, even though it was cloudy and horrible and couldn't see very much.
Well, you made it anyway.
I made it.
And my guest is Tom Choate. As you've been hearing, he climbed Denali at the age of 78. In 2013, and that was, he'd done it every decade since 1963, and it had been climbing around in Denali even in the 1950s. So he's a remarkable guy and so many good stories, and we could probably fill up lots of shows with this. But Tom, I wanted to get into a little bit of what it was like climbing here in Alaska in the 50s and 60s, and kind of how you got into it, how you got interested in doing this, and what because it seems to me like there was no... in those days, there was no safety net, right? You were kind of on your own.
Yeah, Alaska climbing was very adventurous and not necessarily especially difficult. And a number of the peaks in Alaska, including Denali, with care, could be climbed simply essentially by walking and having a lot of experience at figuring out about crevasses more than anything else.
Because of the more snow.
Lots more snow, and it's also kind of a seasonal thing. Mm-hmm. You may recall that a lot of the early expeditions even took dog teams up the Muldrow Glacier and across these crevasses. Well, that can only happen when there's quite a little bit of snow.
Yeah.
And we didn't get our expedition started in 1963 until about the first part of July, because I've been waiting for 5 years after I first wanted to climb it because of the Muldrow Glacier being along a fault line. It had been broken up by a huge earthquake. And there was actually 5 years that nobody could follow this route, and it's the traditional way of climbing the mountain. And I had the privilege of having the leadership of Vin Homan, who was the one who established lots and lots of routes and lots of exploration in Alaska and especially around Anchorage here. And his idea was to copy the early climbers and to do things the old-fashioned way. Mm-hmm. So even though it would have been possible to have a fly-in the way starting to be done over on the southern side. He wanted to start on the ground like the early expeditions. So we essentially set ourselves up to walk across the top of the mountain from Wonder Lake in the park, across the rivers, and finally up onto the ice, and then over the top of the mountain, and all the way down the long, long glacier, the Kahiltna, on the other side. And eventually, when that glacier ended, to beat through the bushes and finally cross the river and come out at Talkeetna. So
wow.
It's supposed to be like the old days,
yeah.
When people would spend a month getting to the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And we also wanted to copy the 1909 expedition, which climbed the North Peak first.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to try their route. So the whole thing went off based on this sort of plan. And yet I was largely the cause of it starting late, because I'd been doing my graduate work and I couldn't even get out of school until the middle of June.
Were you already an experienced mountaineer at that point?
Yeah, I had done, well, not very experienced on ice and snow.
Mm-hmm.
But I had started in the Sierras and done quite a lot of rocky peaks and taken training and so on. And in fact, before then, I started training in mountain rescue and avalanches and sundry things of that sort. So I had a bit of experience, but nowhere near what it turned out I needed for crevasses.
Yeah.
By the end of that expedition, Vin calculated that between the four of us, we'd fallen into 75 crevasses.
Oh, my gosh.
But the thing is, if you got good rope technique, you don't mm-hmm. need to worry about this. And mm-hmm. after the first two or three fall-ins, it's like, well, heck, I only go in about 3 feet, or I go in about 6 feet, because that guy behind me's doing the rope work properly.
Mm-hmm.
You start getting up confidence, and then you can start walking properly and getting some speed up a glacier.
Yeah. So there's so much to ask about, but it strikes me that the biggest difference is, I think, as I place my imagination into those days, is you've got no really weather forecast. So whatever happens, happens weather-wise.
Exactly.
And you've got no one to come get you if something goes wrong. So it's really much more like it would have been in the 19th century walking across Alaska.
Well, we had several modern advantages. The most important one being that because we were going out for 6 weeks, we couldn't really carry more than 2 weeks of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And continue onwards. You can carry 4 weeks of stuff if you're going up, setting camps, coming back, picking up caches of food and all that.
Doing a relay.
We were essentially going from one end to the other. So we set it up to carry 2 weeks worth of stuff. That meant we had to have an airdrop every 2 weeks. So we had two airdrops.
Hmm.
And in that sense, we cheated.
Okay.
We used modern technique
in particular.
I consider
it fair. Fair game. Fair play.
And so there was a possibility if we got in trouble, you'd see an airplane in 2 weeks.
Yeah, well, that's...
And in fact, we had a person get altitude sick.
Oh, wow.
On about the 15,500-foot level.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, he was a really excellent athlete. And mm-hmm. I've discovered over the years that that doesn't necessarily mean you're any good at altitude.
Right. Something genetic, I think. Something physiological.
And also, to my way of thinking, you've trained your muscles maybe to go into negative oxygen debt.
Mm.
I can never do that. I always have to get extra breaths.
Mm-hmm.
But that's partly why I train myself to get the oxygen as I go up the mountain.
Yeah, interesting. So you did that climb. You've done all this work in the Sierras. But then you've had many, many adventures in between, and we don't have all the too much time. In a few minutes, I mean, what are some of your proudest accomplishments in terms of your climbing and your outdoor activity?
Well, I've always been interested in the whole world and been interested in geography, and I thank my parents for getting me interested in the whole world, and also being at the edge of the San Francisco Bay for 8 years, where I could be exposed to people from everywhere and cultures from everywhere. So mm-hmm. I just couldn't resist the world. So as soon as I bumped off a few peaks over here, I set my sights overseas. And I'd gone to college so long that I could work as a teacher and be comparatively independent.
So summer's off, yeah.
And, well, summer's off or summer's research or whatever uh-huh. the case is. But that allowed me to go to New Zealand and climb around on peaks in New Zealand for 4 or 5 years.
Oh, nice.
And once I was down there, then I discovered that it's possible to get to the Antarctic. And so I did four years of Antarctic research. I didn't get to do much climbing down there, but I sure got some interesting exploring. Mm-hmm. And in those days, it was pretty exploratory. There were no tourists. It was all science.
Yeah.
And some military who, as far as I'm concerned, should never have been there.
And what kind of scientific research were you doing?
Oh, I was chasing penguins and uh-huh. their predators and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
But then I couldn't really get an advancement where I was in New Zealand, so I zoomed off to Africa. I fell in love with Africa to the point of working over there for over 10 years. And from Africa, I launched climbs of Kilimanjaro and the ruins of Ouris and things like that, and then also from there to the Himalayas and from there to the Andes.
Huh. Did you do every challenge that you wanted to do? I mean, you've got
The world's too full of challenges. I could make a bucket list of 10 or 15 more places to go, even though I've probably been in 100 countries.
100 countries. Wow. I would have you it seems like you've got this enough stories for a wonderful book or a memoir of some
People
kind.
People always tell me I should write a book. I wrote a book on climbing mm-hmm. in Zimbabwe. And it took so long to get it done, and it took so much research. I had to research 360 climbs, most of which wow. I had to climb myself. And by the time it was all done, and it took so long to publish, when it finally came out, only about 20 or 30 people bought the thing, and then they said it was out of date. So I said, no way, I'm not writing any more books.
Do you, how does Alaska rank among the places that you've climbed in terms of how you feel about it?
Oh, it's fabulous. I'll come back here and climb any day. Uh-huh. And there's no question, for example, that Denali is much more exciting than Mount Everest is.
Oh, really?
Everest is smaller.
Because it
starts from higher. Mm-hmm. And there are all these people and all this hassle over oxygen and whatnot. You fight yourself when you're climbing Denali. Hmm. And you work out a way of doing it without oxygen, and it's different.
Yeah.
And then it has this mystery. There's an album that I will recommend to anyone called The Music of Denali, and there's a song in there about the mystery of it.
Yeah.
And it gets under my skin.
Yeah, I can hear it. I can hear it. So I think anybody would love to be able to say that they would live to 83 and be as fit and energetic and positive and still enjoying outdoors the way you are. Oh.
Hey, I'll go along with positive. And as far as going along with fit, I will say very, very definitely not, especially in recent years, because mm-hmm. as my left hip started to deteriorate, and I finally got it replaced a month ago, then I've probably not done a good aerobic day in 6 months.
Okay.
So yep. I am not fit. I very often fail.
Do you find that frustrating?
To be good. A bit frustrating, but I've not been all that good since my wife died in particular.
Hmm.
Of saying, okay, this is Wednesday, we go to the gym. This is Friday, we're going out to Flat Top or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't quite have the motivation. But maybe I'll have it now that I'm finally getting a new hip again.
Yeah.
The thing that scares me is that they egged me into climbing Denali when I got the first hip. Now I've got a second hip. What the heck are they going to expect me to do? Everest? No way.
Right. Now you have to walk across Antarctica or something. Yeah. Well, I mean,
listen, it's quite important for your listeners to recognize that because I'm an unfit old goat, doesn't mean that I don't have the ambition to try stuff. Mm-hmm. And the same thing applies to so many listeners out there. You don't have to be an athlete. You have to be determined to go through a little pain. And listen, if you go through that first 30 minutes after you get up in the morning or that first 30 minutes of walking, you have all these wonderful chemicals in your body that come in and take over. Why do you need to have these artificial pain pills?
Mm-hmm.
Just go out and put up with a little bit. When you're on a mountain, you might have to put up with a blizzard or being down in a little hole in a crevasse for 20 minutes or something. So, don't let it stop you. Be determined. When I had one-year-old kids, we put them on our back. We went out. Don't let stuff stop you. Most of you people out there can do things like Denali if you're determined enough. Now, go do it.
That's good, and not only for elders. That's good for everyone. Teenagers, too. Just as I get very inspiring, and that's really exactly what I think about when we do this show is, you can. Everybody can do it. Everybody can get out and do something, right? Maybe not as much as you did, but something.
Oh, baloney! They can do it. Just try.
Right. Well, thanks, Tom. I really enjoyed this. This has been a lot of fun. I think we should get you back here for some more stories another time.
My pleasure.
Tom Choate has been my guest, and as you heard, he's climbed just about everything, including climbing Denali at the age of 78, and. Who knows what he'll climb next? I'm not going to count you out at all. So thanks for being here, Tom.
My pleasure.
Stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
This next piece we have for you comes from the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies in Portland, Maine, telling the story of 10-year-old Sarah Nichols training to become a licensed hot air balloon pilot with help from her dad. This was recorded quite a long time ago. By now, Sarah's old enough to have her own kids, but we thought you would enjoy hearing it anyway.
It is a nice, cool morning.
Yeah, no kidding.
It's a chilly autumn morning at a local park in Auburn, Maine. An enormous purple hot air balloon lies on its side in the open green field. Today's pilot will be Jim Rodrigue. He's setting up the burner, or the propane flame that will heat the air inside the balloon and cause it to rise.
Gotta set up the burner, test the burner before we go, make sure it works.
Today's passenger is 10-year-old Sarah Nichols. Instead of going to school this morning, she's going flying. And this is not her first time. In fact, it will be her 50th.
My dream is to have a balloon when I get older, and I want it to be orange, just say Sarah's dream, or to just say dream. I've had this dream since I was 6, when I first went up to the 20 feet and went across the field. It felt like nothing I've ever felt before.
I'm going to light the pilot light. There's 3 pilot lights to light, and I'm going to make some noise. Top is pulled. The radio check.
Sarah's flying by herself today. Her father, Ron, is staying on the ground like he always does. He's petrified of heights. Ron does flooring for a living.
Big difference between her and I is I don't get off the ground. I'm the chase crew. Somebody has to chase that balloon and retrieve it.
Buoyant. You're buoyant.
And we're off.
Have a nice flight.
When we take off, It feels like the ground left me. It's just floating, and I can't fall or anything. When we're floating through the air, it feels like I'm in an airplane. Well, sort of, only really slow, and you can't feel the wind at all.
The balloon has risen high into the air, and you can see for miles.
See the swirls in the river? See how it kind of curls?
Sarah has been up with pilot Jim Rodrigue many times before. Jim's a pro and has been flying in this area for the past 4 years. He knows the patterns of the wind like a well-seasoned sailor.
What's going to happen is when we come down low, that river is going to grab us and put us right down the center of the river. Just want to make sure I clear the church. Oh yeah, what a nice flight.
The balloon drifts silently over the church steeple like a cork on the river. That's the beauty of a balloon flight. It feels and sounds completely effortless.
The houses look like doll houses, like the Polly Pocket houses. People look like ants sometimes. The cars look like matchbox cars.
Although it's Sarah's 50th flight, each flight is different. She has flown above the clouds and has skipped lightly across rivers. She's even gone up in the cover of night, some 2.5 miles above the earth.
We went up at like 2 o'clock in the morning. You couldn't see, it was black. So we had to have these special lights hanging from the balloon, and we went up to like 12,000 feet, and I fell asleep in the bottom of the basket like an hour into the flight. The pilot was shaking me, waking me up, and said, wake up, look, there's a jet plane flying under us. And I'm like, wow.
All right, we're gonna go up, see if we can get a left back into Lewiston, all right?
Okay, I'm sitting right here on the bridge.
When Sarah is 16, she'll be able to apply for her pilot's license. Right now, she needs 10 more hours of fly time to satisfy the license requirements. But this is an expensive sport. Pilot training lessons vary in price, but Sarah's dad, Ron, believes it will cost in the neighborhood of $7,000. To make money, Sarah and Ron have become balloon booking agents. They'll need a lot of business before Sarah can buy her own balloon. They run around $35,000. Fortunately, Sarah is a self-proclaimed number cruncher. She wants to be an accountant when she's older. She even keeps her dad in line.
I told him how much he was spending on Dunkin' Donuts coffee every year.
In a year.
Around $1,600 a year, and I'm like, Dad, you need to stop buying it.
In addition to the financial challenges, finding a mentor has also proven difficult. In a small town like Auburn, Maine, there are only a handful of pilots qualified to teach her, and even fewer who are willing to take her on because of her young age.
I would have thrown my hands up and said, to heck with this. This isn't worth it. And when the time comes, I'll pay for my own lessons and get, you know, someone to train me and go get my license. But her love for it isn't a once-a-year thing. It's not a once-a-month thing. It's all the time.
Looks like we may be going to New Auburn.
Sarah's school is in New Auburn, and in all the time she has flown, she has yet to discover what it might look like from 900 feet in the air.
Looks like we are going to go over Sarah's school.
She grips the edge of the wicker basket. The brilliant purple balloon rises confidently above her. Sarah leans out over the edge. Her face looks calm. She is silent and patient.
That's my school. Right there.
Hundreds of kids stream out of Sherwood Elementary School to see Sarah in the clouds above.
Is your school?
Right there.
A smile spreads across her face, and she eagerly begins waving at her friends down below. It's hard to know whether this 50th flight will stick in her mind in years to come. Sarah has many more flights through the air in her future. Yet she is in no danger of forgetting what brought her to ballooning in the first place.
Felt like a fairy tale. Like, I was floating. I mean, I couldn't believe I was just floating in a basket. It was just magical.
This is Anne Glickman for SALT Radio.
That piece came to us from the SALT Institute for Documentary Studies in Portland, Maine. It was recorded in 2004. Right now, I have in the studio a person who is a real pioneer of the Anchorage running community. Tim Middleton was one of the founders of the Mayor's Marathon and has run an extraordinary number of marathons and done a lot of stuff just supporting the athletic community here in Anchorage. And showing our show's age, it was 5 years ago that we had Tim on in a first year that we were doing Outdoor Explorer to talk about elder athletes, how you keep doing your sport as you're getting older and your body's changing and the things you have to think about to do that. 5 years, well, Tim is 5 years older and some things have changed for him as they have for all of us. So I thought we would check in on today's show just to find out what's happened with him as such an avid runner. And Tim, you were telling me that as we were coming in that you're not running at the moment.
That's correct.
So what's going on?
And I think you have to be supported by what you've done in the past. And mm-hmm. When you started out in the 30s and 40s, I was gung-ho, and every run was faster, and every track or every
You're
training.
Cutting time off every marathon.
Yeah, yeah. And I also was going to 8 miles and then 6 miles, 18 miles, and training and doing marathons. And I did about 61 marathons and a few ultra marathons, including the once 100. What did we call it? Anyway, it's a big
100K.
100 miles.
Oh my gosh, yeah. 100 miles! That's crazy.
So that was in 1986.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt great, and I was really proud of myself and getting better and faster. And then, as I aged, which we ultimately do, can't get around it. And I was doing pretty well in the 50s, and I was doing pretty well in the 60s. Well, then the 70s came, and you have to just adapt yourself. And what I found is that the habits that I started in my early days, middle age, I can adapt and keep my fitness, sort of. I'm still slower than I was, but anyway. But like right now, I can't run. I skied some in the winter. Actually, I skied quite a bit, which was good. But I can bike, and I still keep my. I think I have a fairly good, my the food I eat and
keep a good diet.
Good
keeping
diet,
everything
yeah,
else
which
going,
I
right?
which
yeah.
I which I adopted back when I was trying to be fast in the 70s and 80s, 1970s and 1980s. And I still feel pretty good. And so I haven't, I jokingly say that in my real young days, I used to play chess. So I thought, well, maybe I'll go to a chess club. But I got this big book on chess, which I've had for a long time. I decided I gave it to my 11-year-old, 12-year-old young man who's our, well, he's quite a guy, and, uh-huh. and his sister. So
so you're saying that you're not running.
I gave that to him. So
you're not running, but you're cycling and you're skiing, so you're getting a sort of a roughly the right amount of physical exercise to stay at fitness level. You're just adapting to a different sport that has less impact.
And we do things. We get up in the morning, a bunch of five or six people out in our area, West Anchorage, and we go pick up trash for about an hour. And
oh, really?
That means
so these
that,
are just buddies of yours?
Yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And then we go to the city market for another hour.
To drink some coffee,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And lie about stuff. So And actually, I can maybe run up to walk up to about 2 or 3 miles in the morning. I can't keep that going all day long though. So it's what this is just muscle down my left row, my left leg, and I apparently have overused that section, and I haven't used enough of my glutes.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had some treatment with that, and trying to switch over and get more exercise.
And this is what a physical therapist was able to tell you.
So yeah.
So part of this keeping going is don't give up, but go get diagnosed and figure out what adjustments you can make to your gait.
Yeah, and then just adapt yourself. I mean, so I do. I get the satisfaction of the effort in the morning, and then I get a bike ride in the afternoon. And I just started to ride the bike. I don't have a fat tire bike, but I might be the next step.
Might be the next step, yeah.
But that's a winner.
Well, I see people riding them around in the summer, but I agree they must be awfully slow for summertime. I'd rather ride a quicker bike. So, did you feel a tremendous amount of frustration or just loss when you found out you'd had this injury and you weren't going to be able to run? Maybe you'll get back to it. We hopefully will. But I mean, this has been a huge part of your life for your whole life.
I figure I'll be able to run again when I'm 80. check, chuckle, chuckle. Most guys have already hung up the.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There's not too many 77-year-olds out there running, but I mean, for you, after running 60-plus marathons and all the stuff you've done for the running community, I would think it would be a bit of a withdrawal to suddenly not be able to do it.
And so I'm trying to cure this problem, and I want to do a couple more marathons at Equinox, which is
up in Fairbanks,
yeah, the one which I helped blaze on in 1963. So I'd like to go back and do that and do a real full, I mean, it's not very fast, but the Equinox is, you know, if you're doing a six hour race, that's not bad. Whereas
the elevation gain in that thing is brutal, yeah.
Yeah, so, and of course we're enjoying our two grandkids, mm-hmm. and I just referred to, and they're both really awesome.
That's great. So there's plenty to keep you going. Yeah.
Yeah.
So in terms of getting older, I know a lot of people quit skiing because they're afraid they're going to fall and break a leg or something, and you know, bones get more brittle as they get older, and all that stuff. Also, people lose balance as they get older. I'm wondering if any of those things have affected you.
You know, I see a little bit of when I start skiing in the fall, I get a little funny about my balance, but you know, I didn't fall very, I mean a couple of times through the winter. I don't think I really, it wasn't dramatic, mm-hmm. so but there are guys who they have problems, and I have my contemporaries who are very, very good skiers and runners, and they aren't signing up on the big races. I did, but it was very slow.
Which races did you do this year?
I did the 25K.
Oh, my gosh. In the Tour of Anchorage.
Yeah,
I think I saw you out there, actually.
Yeah.
25K, and that's good, pretty
good
impressive.
Good for him. Jim Mahaffey and his wife were out there in the APU meadow there, and they were cheering me on. And I really enjoyed that. And, of course, he's one of our icons around here. I mean, I don't know if you know about it.
One of the founders of the whole skiing movement in Anchorage.
Oh, yeah. He brought coaching to Fairbanks, and then brought coaching to Anchorage, rather. And he's one of my idols.
Mm-hmm.
So it's fun to see him out. He's in his A little older than I am, yeah. I won't tell you what.
But, I mean, there's a good number of guys in your generation who are still out there skiing and doing stuff and being pretty active, though you might be leading the pack.
I think they're going to the fat tires mm-hmm. a lot.
Rather than skiing, yeah.
And I just don't see them out on in the trails skiing. And
yep.
I always ask them about how they're doing, and they kind of noncommittal.
Okay, there you go. When you run into a city yeah. market, it's like, so don't get any specifics.
Yeah, don't get any specifics.
You get suspicious at
which
that
point. Would be probably the same. So, not in this. Yeah.
You're not trading times anymore. Yeah.
No, I know. I'm not trading times anymore. So, yeah, and of course, yeah. You can still do stuff and help things for the community.
Yeah.
And,
that's great. Yeah. I mean, you say you want to get back and do the Equinox again. That seems like a pretty big goal. I mean, to do a marathon, not only a marathon, but a really tough marathon. And you're 77 years
yes,
old.
Yes, Dad.
I mean, is that really, I mean,
yes,
that you're going to do that?
Okay.
No, you got the goal. Okay, I'm not going to try to rain on your parade.
Yeah, yeah, right. So we'll see. Other people, you're not the only one that, you know.
I think that's
but you
stretch,
have to yeah. try.
Yeah.
So, you know, and, yeah, we'll see.
We'll see. I think you can do it. I'll be counting on you.
Yeah. Another booster.
There you go.
Encouragement. Okay, Dad.
All right. Well, thanks for coming in, Tim. And I mean, it's really good to see you again, and it's good to hear you are still doing this stuff and an inspiration for me. I got at least another 20 years to go before I
so
can.
Here's 57.
I'm about to turn 55. So, yeah.
You'll see a big.
I'm on the downhill slope.
It's a slight downhill slope, and then when you hit 60, it goes up a little bit more, and then you hit 70, you go.
Yeah, well, I don't want
to hear about that. It plunges to the abyss.
Yeah, really. Well, I mean, I think I've certainly had to deal with the fact that my times are not going to get faster anymore. They're getting slower, you know. Mm-hmm. And part of that is the fact that I think my body's changed, but the other part is I just don't care as much anymore, right? I just, you know, I don't feel as competitive. I feel like, oh, well, this is fun, you know.
Yeah.
I have a good time. Yeah. And that's fine.
Well, I haven't written out my times and what I've been writing every usually write every year in my calendar, so many miles and so on.
Don't bother anymore. Huh?
Don't bother that anymore. It's 3 miles, yeah, maybe. But
uh-huh. So. Yeah. That sounds good. All right. Thank you, Tim Middleton.
So we'll see you in 5 years.
Yeah, that's right. I'll see you 5 years from now. All right. Tim Middleton's my guest. My name is Charles Wolforth. It's Outdoor Explorer. Stay with us. Our last segment on today's show is from Alaska Public Media's India Alaska series. What does it take to keep bees alive in Alaska? Strong genetics. We're going to hear Keith Malone and Nathan Bromley talking about going back to the basics with beekeeping. Through genetic tweaks and all natural methods, they learn to keep their hives happy and healthy year-round.
I had a hive that had a real mean mother, and I decided I was going to change the genetics because this hive was always stingy. Took me about an hour to find the queen because they were actually protecting the queen, keeping her, they had a ball around her. I got about 100 stings that day. I found the queen, I X'd her head off, they made a new queen, but the next year they survived the winter and they made me a lot of honey the next year. And they weren't stingy anymore.
We're taking out queen cells, they're just starting to think about swarming.
Well, I've been working for about 5 or 6 years, or 7 or 8, I think, selecting and also bringing in select genetics from places like Vermont and Washington. I'm looking for a bee that can endure our length of winter, which takes a conservative bee. The main reason why bees don't survive Alaska is the duration plus starvation. Some beekeepers in Alaska choose to kill their bees. To me, they're too precious to kill. It's going to be a long road to make beekeeping sustainable in Alaska. A lot of people need to work on it.
Being an owner of a supplement and natural food store, wintering the bees rather than killing them and not using chemicals and using natural cell size just fit in with what I'm about. Keith used to come in and buy essential oils and calendula and stuff like that, and I had heard about him a little bit and didn't quite know who he was. He was, he's a little bit of an outlaw, I guess you could say, in the beekeeping community up here because he's into wintering his bees.
We started exchanging information about beekeeping. It's good to talk with Nathan about bees because he picks it up good.
And at first it was just, basically he was just my mentor in beekeeping, but we do a lot together now business-wise as well. We're like peas and carrots, beans and rice, mustard and ketchup, cowboys and cowboy hats. So anyways, what I do, they're still there, I'll show them to you. Anyways,
I remember that.
I'm talking to the camera, man.
Why don't you talk with the camera?
Most people have heard by now that there's a huge loss every year of honeybees down in the lower 48, especially, you know, 25%, 40%, I mean, it's huge every year. It didn't make any sense to me personally to do what they're doing. They're failing, really.
They're theorizing that it's between antibiotics, chemicals, herbicides, anything and everything. What I think it is beekeepers trying too hard. And they need to simplify their beekeeping and get them on a natural system.
Other than zero treatments, and treatments could be anything from essential oils, giving them fake pollen, you know, mitaway, miticides, fungicides. Those are all unnatural, obviously. And what it's done over the years is it's created an environment where you end up with weak bees and strong mites and bugs and stuff.
There's a lot of beekeepers that are frustrated with the system that's currently in place. A lot of beekeepers don't want to put stuff in a hive that the bees wouldn't bring in on their own. They're being propped up by chemicals.
People don't like change, and if that's what they've been taught, then the Honeybee Association tells you to do that, and Monsanto buys a bee genetics company and comes up with a bogus reason of why that's a good thing. People do it, so is that too political?
At least.
Let's introduce these bees to the box.
Oh, see my face. One of the two. Make sure I'm zipped up. Whoa. Oh my gosh.
That was Indy, Alaska with beekeepers Keith Malone and Nathan Brumley. And that's all for today's show. I want to thank our earlier guests as well. We heard from Tom Choate, a climber and adventurer who has been topping mountains for 50 years. And we heard from the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies, a piece called Sarah's Dream of Owning a Hot Air Balloon. And Tim Middleton came with us. He's an Anchorage running pioneer and has completed more than 60 marathons. Our producer on Outdoor Explorer is Eric Bork. Assistant producer, who lines up our guests, is Hannah Duro. My name is Charles Woolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.